today because the respondent, Bragg Corp, intentionally and maliciously made false and defaming written and verbal statements regarding Ms. McDonald. In Ms. McDonald's complaint, she lists at least 7 different acts that constituted defamation on behalf of respondent Bragg Corp. She also alleged at least 17 violations of the Code of Ethics for Journalists. All of these instances were put forth in her complaint and were then later submitted in the form of a memorandum in a response to respondent's motion for summary judgment in this case.
But no affidavit?
There was an affidavit verifying the complaint, yes.
Was it an affidavit that satisfies the summary judgment standard for admissibility?
We believe so, yes.
If it wasn't, in our de novo review, would it be a document that we would consider?
Yes, I believe all the documents set forth should be considered.
But if it's not, if we determine de novo review that it doesn't meet the requirements of an affidavit to be submitted for summary judgment, even if the district court considered it, we would not. Do you agree with that?
If that was your finding, yes. The memorandum was submitted and several genuine issues of material fact were set forth. Summary judgment is only proper where the moving party demonstrates that there are no genuine issues of material fact. In this case, the court made determinations on the merit of the facts, which was inappropriate. The court at that point was only supposed to make a determination as to whether or not genuine issues of material fact existed, not to make a determination on the merit of those facts, not to make credibility determinations, but just to determine whether or not genuine material issues of fact existed. And there were many. Where reasonable people would have a difference of opinion on the facts, summary judgment is not appropriate. And it's clear in this instance that the parties absolutely agreed. And by the submissions put forth by the respondent and the submissions put forth by the appellant, that the facts were disputed and therefore needed to be determined by a jury.
So one of the disputes that I think I see as fundamental in this case is whether or not your client is a public figure, right? Because if she's a public figure, then because if she's not a public figure, then you don't have the actual malice standard and there's not this what's seen as a bar to the defamation by implication. Is that a matter of fact that's disputed, or is that a legal determination for the judge to make from your perspective?
From our perspective, it's a matter of fact.
What is the case law that supports that position?
Your Honor, may I?
Yes.
I do believe we outlined that in our brief as to what the how a public figure has been defined, and that it's our position that the definition used by the court was misplaced.
Well, my question, though, is what is the most compelling authority you found for the idea that that is a fact question that a judge is not to determine at summary judgment, that being the status of the plaintiff as either a public figure or not?
I do believe that is outlined in our brief.
And if you like, you can address that on rebuttal.
May I? May I do that?
Certainly.
Thank you. Since the court did bring up the issue of malice, I would like to address that. Even if at any point in time, Respondent Bragg Corp believed that Ms. McDonald was a person of interest. Even at any time if he believed that, once he became aware that that was in fact not true, he had a duty not to continue to perpetuate that false information to the public.
I thought the evidence presented, at least by Mr. Bragg Corp, was that that was something that he believed based upon information you received from law enforcement?
Yes, and that was exactly my point, Your Honor. If he believed it at one point in time and then he became aware that that was not the case, he has a duty not to continue to perpetuate untruths. Even if it was true at one time, once you become aware that it is untrue, you have a duty not to perpetuate untruths to the public regarding another person. And Respondent Broad Corp did not do that. He continues even to this day, 2019,
What's
reporting that.
What's the best evidence you presented to the district court, admissible evidence, to demonstrate that there was a basis for him to withdraw his perception of your client as a person of interest?
Well, I believe in our pleadings, it's noted that Lakeville Police let Ms. McDonald know that she was not a person of interest. Also, the fact that the defendants involved in that particular case that we're referencing had gone to trial, had been convicted, and had been sentenced. So the case was over. So
my question is not how would your client come to believe that she was not a person of interest, but what's the evidence in the record that is the most compelling that would lead us to agree with you that the defendant was on notice that he was mistaken in the information he had received earlier that your client was a person of interest in the investigation?
Okay, those examples that I shared were put in the pleadings, but there were also several letters that have been submitted for evidence that show that he was advised that this was not true, and he was asked
advised.
To cease and desist. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Your Honor.
He was advised by whom?
My client.
Okay, so if he was, as he says, was informed by law enforcement that your client was a person of interest,
mm-hmm.
Your view is that once your client asserts that she's not a person of interest, he's then on notice so that he can no longer reasonably hold his view without actually being malicious.
And that kind of goes to...
You're answering yes to that question?
Do I believe that he has a right to still hold that belief?
No, my question is, you said that there was a basis for him to, even if he had the view at one time, mm-hmm. because he was informed by law enforcement, once he became aware that she wasn't a person of interest, it then became malicious for him to continue to exercise communication based upon his viewpoint. I was asking you for evidence in the record that would help us to agree with you that he had that moment where he was informed that she was no longer a person of interest. And you've identified so far mm-hmm. your client telling him that she didn't believe she was a person of interest.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the only evidence there is?
That is the only evidence. She told him time and time again.
So why would that be a basis in law if the defendant hears from law enforcement that your client is a person of interest and your client says, no, I'm not? Your position is, as a matter of law, he's required to accept your client's representation over what he's heard from law enforcement.
My position is that as a journalist, if that's what he's claiming to be, he has a duty to report truthful accounts. And so once he becomes aware that they are not true, he also has a duty not to continue to report them.
If we could go back to my concern over this public figure,
okay,
which I think is a linchpin to several of these legal arguments. So I think you would agree with me, but correct me if I'm wrong. So Ms. McDonald is not a public official, but the theory is she was a public figure when she was running for office. I think that's at least the theory. And so my question is, mm-hmm. were there periods of time where, from your perspective, she wasn't running for office, but the defamatory, what you believing were defamatory comments, were taking place? In other words, if we did not accept the district court's theory mm-hmm. that at some point Ms. McDonald became a perennial candidate, but she was only a public figure when she was a candidate, are there arguably some defamation claims not subject to the actual malice bar?
Yes, it's very clear.
You point us to those.
It's very clear when Ms. McDonald ran for Supreme Court Justice. So even if the court concluded that she was a public figure at that time, when she was not running, she would not, under that theory, right, or that determination, be a public figure, and the defamation, and the point is that the defamation has continued from 2015 until even until today.
So the person, that's why I'm trying to get more specific here, so some of the person of interest comments, did some of that happen when she was not running for office?
Yes. 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 And
so how does that work as a matter of law? A person floats in and out of public figure status?
Well, if the court determines that she's a public figure when she's running for Supreme Court justice, then yes, that would absolutely be the case. Because just as a layperson sitting here today, she's not a public figure.
If a person is consistently running for office, is it your view that it's only during the actual election period that the person is a public figure? And if so, what are the parameters of that, since there's no official beginning and end except for the filing, I suppose?
Right, and it's not really clear in any rule of law or case law. So my position would be that if the determination was that when you're running for office, you are a public figure, then only the period of in which you are running would then constitute your public figure status.
How do you define that period? Is it from the filing? Is it from the announcement of participation? Is it how would you define that, and why would that, and when you choose a definition for when it begins and ends, help us to understand why, as a practical matter, that should be the parameter for the purposes of defamation.
I think it could go either way, Your Honor. I think some people might think once you make the announcement and you put yourself out there, you know, you're in the public eye and you're the public figure. But for me, it would probably be when you actually do the filing, because I do know of situations where people have made announcements that they're going to run for something and then they withdraw and they don't actually file. So I think probably the time of filing would be a good point to set as the starting point. Okay. So the summary judgment happened in this case, and we do believe it was premature because, as you know, there was no answer filed, there was no discovery, there was nothing that had taken place in this case. And the rule is very clear about what the record has to be based or consist of in order for summary judgment to be appropriate. And none of that had occurred in this case. The only thing that had happened was the filing of Ms. McDonald's complaint and then a motion by respondent. Then we proceeded with a default judgment, and they, in response, filed a motion for summary judgment.
Now, the rules for governing summary judgment allow for summary judgment, quote, at any time. It's a federal rule, it's a state rule, it's pretty consistent in the law. What's your most significant authority for the proposition that there's a moment where summary judgment might be premature?
Well, I think Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 56.03, where it says that summary judgment is appropriate where the pleadings, depositions, answers to interrogatories, and admissions on file, together with the affidavits, if any, show that there is no genuine issue as to any material fact.
Right. So if any. So you take that in context with the rule that says summary judgment applies at any time. The district court may order it at any time. Why would there be a moment when it's premature? As a matter of law or as a matter of procedural rules, were you able to find any case to support your proposition that there is such a moment?
Well, I think the plain language of the rules is referring to if any affidavits. I don't think if any of all of the pleadings that I mentioned before, Your Honor. That's not how I read the
rule. Let me go back to my question.
Okay.
Were you able to find any authority to support your proposition?
Of regarding the premature? Argument? Not anything that specifically says premature, Your Honor.
I guess what troubles me about your argument in this regard is, I mean, you're talking about Rule 56.03, but mm-hmm. Rule 56.04, you know, gives parties the right to say, judge, delay this hearing. I need more discovery. But at least from my review of the record, you didn't do that. Is that fair to say?
I'm sorry, file a motion under Rule 56.04?
Yes, asking for additional discovery or delaying the hearing, the summary judgment hearing.
No, we did not.
Once you, Mike, going back, why is there prejudice then to your client? If the rules provide an avenue for you to say, judge, under 04, we would like more information. We need more discovery. You need something more before you decide summary judgment. And the onus then, it seems, the rule puts on your client. Why is your client prejudiced by the district court's decision if you had that opportunity and didn't avail yourself of it?
Oh, we're not claiming prejudice, Your Honor. We're claiming the not being able to have the opportunity to proceed with litigation and have discovery and to be heard on the claims contained in the complaint.
But why isn't the district, if there's error in the district court's premature decision, why isn't it harmless error since the rule provides an avenue for your client to avoid that prematurity and your client did not avail herself of it?
Because we feel that they abuse their discretion. They also have discretion to extend the time period to answer, to allow my client to be able to receive a procedural due process as well.
Did you make a procedural due process argument in the district court?
We did not. I believe my time is up.
Thank you very much. You'll have additional 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Nathan Hansen. I'm here today representing the respondent, Michael Broadcorb, and Missing in Minnesota, LLC. I'm going to cut right in here to this public figure issue because I think it is kind of the linchpin of this case. And I think a nice place to start would be with the appellant's brief. On the top of page 35 of their brief, they write, Ms. McDonald ran for office and lost elections in November of 2014 and 2016 and was running for office at the time of the lawsuit. So at the time this lawsuit was started, Ms. McDonald was a candidate for statewide office.
Well, at the time of the lawsuit, I think that is that the period of our concern? Isn't the period of the concern the time of the alleged defamatory statements, not the time of the filing of the lawsuit?
I think it's a continuum of everything. She ran 2014, ran 2016, was running at the time of this lawsuit, and I think kind of once you're a public figure, once you run for statewide office and, you know, a few years' time, you're a public figure.
So a few years' time? I'm just trying to get my hands around this. So if I ran for public office last year, does that mean, you know, 20 years from now I'm still a public figure, assuming I'm no longer on the bench?
I don't think that analysis is necessary in this case, given the facts that are before the court, because we're talking about a period within the last few years, and presently at the time when she started the lawsuit. I don't think it is a timing issue, and I think it's also significant in this case. The office she was running for was a statewide office, so even your honors offices are divided by region and so forth, and then there's an at-large office. But this is a Supreme Court position. This is a statewide office. There's a very few of those in addition to...
Our offices are also statewide, even though they're jurisdictional.
Oh, they do come out that way.
But Mr. Hansen, do you have any authority, any case that says that someone who ran for public office and lost is a public figure outside of that time when they're running for office, or at least announced they're running for office? Because I haven't seen any, and I didn't see any either.
I think it's just, you know, it's a finding that the trial court below made, that the judge made a specific finding that she was a public figure. And I think it's just an analysis based upon the facts before the court, which could be any number of permutations of facts depending on who the person is.
You agree it's a factual issue, not a legal issue?
Yeah, and I think it's a factual issue that was resolved here by the court by operation of judicial notice, because It's very easy for a district court judge in Minnesota to notice that, to take judicial notice that someone was a candidate for statewide office in the state of Minnesota. She was not a candidate in the state of California or Hawaii or anywhere else.
Were you able to find any case law? I mean, this question of public figure is one that's not just unique to, not unique to Minnesota. Were you able to find any case law anywhere in the country that would help us, guide us in our timing, the timing question, when is a person in or out of the public arena as a public figure, particularly someone who's running for office?
I don't have any specific authority on that. I think it's just an analysis that you make based upon the facts before the court.
Are there any cases that would guide us as to the parameters, not necessarily as to specific timing, but just from what you look for to determine whether someone's a, whether someone who once was a public figure continues to be? When does that period end?
I don't have any case law from other jurisdictions, if that's the question.
Or from Minnesota?
Or from Minnesota. I don't have any specific authority other than what we've outlined in our brief. But I think in this case, it's really not, I don't know if it's really a serious question. Well, it's a serious question because it's a legal question, but...
Well, since we're asking about it.
It is a statewide office here. I mean, you're seeking endorsements at political conventions.
Let's assume we're going to publish on this question, and we have to establish a rule of law to determine the on and off moment of public figure status. What would that rule of law be? How would we guide potential plaintiffs and defendants in defamation cases as to when an individual is a public figure?
I think you leave it up to the discretion of the trial court because of the number of permutations you can have about who's a public figure. Somebody could be a public figure for a lot of different reasons. So, we're not just talking about somebody running for statewide office. Somebody could be a public figure for any number of reasons. And so I really don't think that this determination of public figure is susceptible to some sort of specific formula with regard to...
Maybe not a formula, but what would be the guiding principles that we apply? I mean, even if we don't issue a rule of law for others, we have to decide this case based upon some parameters. What guides us?
I think it would be it should be left to the discretion of the trial of the fact finder.
There was no fact finder on this. I mean, this is a summary judgment question. It's a question of law, isn't it?
The judge made a factual finding. It's in the order that Ms. McDonald's a public figure based upon her status as a perennial candidate for statewide office in Minnesota. That was the finding that was made in the judge's order in this case.
It's summary judgment.
Yes.
So if we're deciding as a matter of law, I mean, we have to review that finding based upon what's in the record. So what is the legal standard? I mean, you can't be asking us to say the district court just can say whatever it wants, and there's no limit to the discretion as to the determination of public figure status. So
are you asking for a standard of review?
I'm asking for a standard. What is the standard of law that we apply to determine when someone is a public figure and when they're not?
I think if you're thinking of a standard of review, it would be abusive discretion. I mean, if a judge made a ridiculous finding.
Right, and how do we decide, okay, so if it's an abusive discretion standard, I'm not sure if that's so, but let's assume that it is an abusive discretion standard. In our review of whether the district court abused its discretion, there must be some legal parameters to determine, to have guided the district court, standards that we have to apply on review. Otherwise, how could we say whether the district court acted within its discretion?
That's an interesting point. I don't know of any specific case law that sets forth those parameters outside what we put in our brief.
You seem to be saying that the determination of whether someone's a public figure or not is a jury question, because it's a factual finding.
Well, it's not a. You could make it based upon judicial notice. A court can take judicial notice any time, and that's what occurs.
Well, you take judicial notice of facts, yeah. And then you have to come up with a legal conclusion. So the question is, what facts are necessary to determine when someone's a public figure? And what I'm not sure we have an answer to.
In this case, we have. It's a matter of public record that this person was a candidate for. If in this case, It's not subject to any reasonable dispute whatsoever and susceptible to judicial notice with the Secretary of State's office that this person was, and in media reports that are all over the place, that this person was a candidate for statewide office.
Mr. Hanson, from my perspective, and I think this may be really actually a question of law, whether a plaintiff is a public figure. And I'm looking at the Jabwin versus Minneapolis Star Tribune case. So just if you'll bear with me as a hypothesis. So that's my reading of it. And then that case, it says, well, there are different categories of public figures, and it would seem to me one of those categories is they called a limited person as public figure who attained their position by thrusting themselves into a vortex of a public controversy. You know, but that would seem to me, if that is the area where Ms. McDonald is a public figure in that sense, that you can also take yourself out of the controversy. And that's how I have concerns about being a public figure for just indefinite period of time because one has run for office. Can you help me with that?
Well, who is Ole Savior a public figure?
That's my question.
Our perennial
candidates.
That's
a question for you.
Yeah, our perennial candidates, public figures, and I think yes. I think if you are somebody, I think when we're talking about somebody who is officially a registered candidate for statewide office, It gets you there. But when you're talking about thrusting yourself into some sort of area of public controversy, that is perhaps a more subjective analysis, but I don't think it applies in this case because we don't have to go there.
Well, you do if there are gaps. I think that's the concern. If you can be a public figure while you're running for office, and I think that's the argument that Ms. McDonald is making, is that if you run for office during that period, whether it's from the filing until the election or from the announcement until the election, if you're an unsuccessful candidate, the argument is surely there must be some moment where it ends. And I think you seem to be suggesting that if you're a perennial candidate, then there really is no, even if you're not officially a candidate at that moment, because you have put yourself out there as sort of a perennial candidate for an office, that you're always a public figure until you get to the point where you just stop running. Is that what your position is? I'm not trying to dodge your question.
I'm not trying to dodge the question, but I think in this case, their assertion in their brief that she was a candidate for statewide office when she started the instant action.
At the time of the action, but doesn't our question about whether you're in public office or whether you're a public figure have to do with when the defamation occurred, not when you filed a lawsuit?
And again, in this case on page 35, and we're talking about a continuum of dates from 2014, presumably to the present, they start in November of 2014 during the time of these things. Another candidacy statewide in 2016, and at the time they instituted this instant action. That's why, I mean, if she would have been a candidate maybe 20 years ago, or something, it might be, and been a private citizen ever since, it might be a different analysis. But as these facts are set before us, I don't think that inquiry is necessary. I do want to note one other thing with the rest of my time, real quickly. In this issue of default judgment was briefed extensively, or in their opening brief. On page 3 of their reply argument, in the last paragraph, 3 lines down, they seem to concede that they're no longer arguing about the default judgment. They write, Ms. McDonald is not arguing that the denial of the default judgment was an error. So I think that argument is, I guess by concession in this reply brief, has been conceded. So with regard to that, with regard to this discovery thing that they raised, they didn't raise any discovery issues below. They didn't exercise any rights to have the hearing moved or anything like that. They were able to be fully heard at the hearing. The due process question was not raised below. And in this case, this arises out of a case where Ms. McDonald had a client who was alleged that she secreted these children away. There was media coverage about it. That's what the Missing in Minnesota blog was. It turned into a book that's out now called The Girls Are Gone. And Mr. Broadcorp has been a journalist on this issue for quite some time. And I think that that's another consideration. He's not just some private individual. I mean, he's a private individual, but he's somebody who's a journalist in good faith trying to cover these things. He covered this series of events and has faced numerous lawsuits or, you know, harassment restraining order and this appeal or this defamation action. And to some extent, to a large extent, he should be afforded some, there is no, I guess that this goes to the absence of actual malice. There is nothing pled in their complaint, even though the complaint is quite lengthy, that points to one specific thing that says, well, we can tell because he did X, Y, or Z that he's acting, you know, he did this to show actual malice. So there is no factual allegation in this case, and their complaint is unverified. I reviewed it again, the one that they, before I came in here, just to make sure that that's correct. The complaint is not a verified complaint.
Now, the district court did treat the affidavit as if it were evidence and decided it on the merits. What's your position as to what we should do on appeal, given our review being de novo, on the question of the whether to consider the affidavit?
I think if the court considered the affidavit, it's probably okay.
What do you mean?
Well, I didn't brief anything. how should I say this?
The McDonald affidavit, I don't think was notarized.
If it's unnotarized or if it's unsworn pursuant to the statute, I know that the statute changed about it, so I think that this would turn on the timing of that statute of, you know, if you can say in the absence of a notary, you know, under penalty of perjury, the foregoing is true and correct.
If you want to take a few seconds to wrap up, your time is done, but if there are a few
sentences.
No, I
don't have anything
sentences.
Further. Okay. Thank you.
Well, then thank you. Any rebuttal?
As a general rule,
if you just introduce yourself at the beginning.
Carlobe Adams Powell.
Thank you.
Thank you. As a general rule, the truth or falsity of a statement is a question for the jury. The panel raises raised some very good questions while Mr. Hansen was up here. And what we are, the period we are concerned about, if the court agrees with the district court's determination that Ms. McDonald was a public figure when she was running for office, the period we are concerned with are the gaps, are the times when she was not running for Supreme Court justice, so and the defamation continued.
How would you answer the question I asked Mr. Hansen? If we were to decide this case in your client's favor, what is the rule of law that we would establish to guide parties to know the timing of the public figure status, not the substance, but the timing?
I would think that once you file and you're in the race and you're running, and then at the time that the race ends or the election ends, that's when the period would end.
So you don't consider if there's a what I'll just refer to as a perennial candidate, someone who runs repeatedly for office, you're suggesting they're not a public figure outside of the filing and period and between the filing period and the election?
Or when the election ends?
Yes.
Right, because as Justice Jessen described, the individual is thrusting themselves in the public eye during the election.
Right, but if they're
and then they retreat.
I'm sorry. If they're a perennial candidate, however, I guess I'm trying to get a sense of the retreat. There is for some. I'm not saying necessarily for your client, but we all know of people in the public arena over the years who have who've run perennially, and isn't there an argument that they've never actually retreated just because the election is not exactly the election cycle is in a period where you're between actual campaigns?
I think you would have to determine that on a case-by-case basis, and my client, when she's not running, is not thrusting herself in the public eye. She does absolutely retreat And so those periods when she retreated and was no longer in the public eye for the purposes of running for Supreme Court justice are the times that we are concerned where the defamation occurred and continues.
Can you address the question I raised originally about the affidavit? Now, the district court did consider your client's affidavit on the merits.
Mm-hmm.
The rule does say that an affidavit supporting affidavit, whether it's for in support of the default or for summary judgment, an affidavit means a signed, sworn, and notarized document. My understanding is that your client's affidavit was not notarized.
So how would I answer? Oh, as to how you should treat the affidavit? Is
yes.
that the question? I think I actually agree with Mr. Hansen. It would depend on when the rule came down and the timing and all of that.
And so how does that affect us now, given the timing of the rule and the notice and the affidavit itself?
Well, depending on if the affidavit was done before the rule came down.
I mean, that's what I'm asking you. Was it?
Then you should uphold the district court's
determination.
That's
what I'm asking you. Was it?
I believe it was, and I believe that's why the district court accepted it. With regard to malice, even malice is absolutely present here. I mean, it's clear from our brief, it's clear from the complaint that there was no other reason that Mr. Broadcorp was continued publishing this photo and continued making these statements other than to be malicious towards Ms. McDonald. And he did not begin doing this until Ms. McDonald's client filed a restraining order against him and Ms. McDonald refused to speak to him. He is not operating as a journalist in good faith because he's posting the picture outside of any seemingly related advertising content or media content. He's just posting it and publishing it willy-nilly just because he wants to. Malice and intentional malice absolutely is present here. No privilege exists, and Mr. Broadcorp has violated several of the journalist ethics that are listed in our brief. And for that reason, we ask that this matter be reversed and remanded, and an answer be required, and discovery be allowed to continue.
Well, thank you both very much for the briefs and the oral arguments today. The court will take the matter under advisement, and an opinion will be issued within 90 days.